Even to this day, I was in Wales over the weekend, and you know, you see the Welsh flag everywhere, and it elicits a very different response in me to the St. George's Cross, which is ostensibly my flag.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. Colin Grant talks to Zakia Zuhl about her book, Finding Albion.
I should say that I read a lot of books and I've never won an award, which I'm not unhappy about, but I do have a special award, which I call the Best Book Read by Colin Grant Award. and that award this year goes to Zakia Zuhl.
Thank you, Colin.
It's a really special book, and I think it's really nice to be in the presence of a burgeoning star, which I think you are. And I wonder if we could just begin initially to unpack the title, which is called Finding Albion. Can I begin by asking you, what did you hope to find? What did you hope to find?
Well, I think when I set out on this quest, I suppose I was searching for a more inclusive, progressive vision of Britishness that I could, you know, felt I could be a part of. You know, I'm born in Britain. Both my parents were born here. My dad is English with kind of Welsh roots. My mum is from an island called Carriacou in the Caribbean, which is part of the Grenadines. And so, you know, in many ways, I feel very at home here. I spent lots of time in Wales when I was growing up, exploring the enchanted landscapes of West Wales and, you know, hearing the kind of stories of Merlin whispered in the wind. And, you know, I felt really at home until, of course, I sort of came into my teenage years and sort of realized that I kind of had this mixed identity, this mixed racial identity, and that I was sort of torn between worlds. And I found it difficult to sort of reconcile the love that I had for Britain and, you know, kind of Midsummer Murders with my grandparents and cups of tea and biscuits and all the lovely, cozy aspects of British culture, with the kind of stories that I inherited from my mum's side of the family, you know, what it meant to be part of the Windrush generation, to be faced with racism and discrimination, and the stories that I inherited about my ancestors who were, you know, transported from West Africa in tightly packed wooden ships and forced to work as slaves under British instruction. Now, as you may, you might be able to tell, it's quite a complicated place to be. And so I wanted to seek out an alternative British story, you know, one that wasn't a kind of sort of wrapped in reverence of military monarchy and empire, but that was an alternative Britain that I'd always sensed. And perhaps we'll talk a little bit about how.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think what we might do to start off, we're going to hear some music that it sort of percolates through the book. And if we could ask Mark, I think it's called, to play the first song.
Oh, the cuckoo, she's a pretty bird. She sings as she flies. She bringeth good tidings. She
That's The Cuckoo by Pentangles. What does that song mean to you?
It still gives me goosebumps whenever I hear it, the twinkling glockenspiels. Yeah, that song, well, my dad took me to see Pentangle when I was 15 years old. It was their 40th anniversary concert at the Royal Festival Hall down in London.
You were 15?
I was 15.
You have to be dragged to the...
Exactly. Yeah, this is the thing. When I was 15, I kind of, you know, I was going through a bit of a rude girl era. So, you know, scraped back hair, big hoop earrings. I was listening to grime and R&B. Absolutely not, you know, cosmic folk. And yet my dad, you know, was really into music. That was a big part of, you know, we bonded over music. And I must have been quite open-minded even back then. So, you know, I kept it a secret from my school friends. Nobody knew that I was going to see this strange old folk band. But something about the music that I heard that evening, it transported me to what felt like another Britain, a Britain that was sort of magical and enchanted. And I just remember coming home from the gig, downloading Basket of Light, which, you know, that song is on, recorded in 1969, and hearing these kind of age-old folk songs, but embellished with kind of jazz and blues, and just being utterly captivated. And it was really Pentangle's music that kind of kick-started my obsession with all things folk. You know, I started listening to some of the other folk artists from that kind of 1960s, 70s revival, people like Shirley Collins and Davy Graham. I started becoming curious about the pagans and the druids and sort of these strange standing stones and stone circles that kind of litter the British landscape. And then from there I started to become interested in the kind of seasonal customs that happen all across the country, things like Morris dancing and, you know, the tar barrels at Ottery St. Mary. And, you know, I think it was because they seemed to emanate from a very, very different Britain to the Britain that is sort of, you know, celebrated in our more conventional national mottos and tales and symbols. They were kind of eccentric and radical and mischievous and strange. And those are the sort of aspects of British culture that I'm going in search of in the book.
So I know your grandparents are in Wales. I think you were brought up in Bedford, is that right?
My mum's from Bedford.
Mum's from Bedford. Where were you brought up?
I was brought up in West London.
In West London.
Quite close to Heathrow Airport. Not particularly folky place. in fact, I went to school, you know, there's a big South Asian community where I grew up. So I grew up, you know, with going to sort of Diwali celebrations and doing Asian dance at school, but not really any English kind of folk traditions.
Mm-hmm. And what relationship would you say you had with the landscape? Did you go walking, hiking?
In Hounslow.
There's never to hike.
It's funny, you sort of think like there seems to be no landscape in Hounslow. You know, it's a very built up place, quite sort of grey. It's sort of like the suburban. It's kind of like, I think it's zone 5 or 6, you know, it's sort of the tail end of the Piccadilly line in London.
Well, that's near St. Margaret's and Richmond, isn't it? All those
places. There was a bit of that. But it was really, I kind of had this sort of split screen, I suppose, growing up. The kind of very urban existence in Hounslow where I was only really allowed to sort of do loops of a block of flats on my bike, and then going to Wales, where I had this kind of 1970s-esque childhood, where I was free to roam with a gang of local kids. And I think that it was in Wales that I first made a connection to the land. And I suppose that that's something that's also really stuck with me. You know, although there have been questions about whether I belong in Britain, and of course there have been people who've let me know that perhaps I shouldn't feel any sense of belonging here, that connection to the land, you know, when it's just me in a field, you know, swimming in the sea, up on a cliffside, being bashed around by the wind, there's no question about whether I belong. You know, there's absolutely, I feel like I belong to this landscape. But it's unfortunately something that has been called into question.
Yeah, it's curious, because you're brown. Are you okay with brown?
Yeah.
I'm brown, or black and brown. And I grew up in a place called Luton. And the idea that we'd go for a walk, we lived approximate to another town called Dunstable, and there are Dunstable Downs. They're 2 miles away, but we never went there. And I just wonder whether you have a theory about why brown or black people in the past, maybe less so now, wouldn't go out into the landscape, into the countryside.
Well, it's funny, isn't it, that we're sort of, you know, us brown and black folk are kind of associated with the urban. Because when I think about my grandparents' experience back home, when I visit Karakou, it's completely rural. You know, my grandparents grew up, you know, growing their own food. They had pigs and they had chickens, and they would slaughter them at, you know, special times of the year. They would be, you know, going on long walks. They'd be swimming in the sea. It was totally a rural existence. Obviously, that all changed when they arrived over here. But I think there's a sort of colonial mindset that I think has something to do with it. You know, the idea that people, the city, the metropolis somehow represented a kind of, you know, civilization and a kind of moving away from backyard. And, you know, the idea that, you know, once you've got your nice house set up in wherever in West London or in Bedford or in Bristol, wherever people migrated to, the idea of going back into back to the land, you know, back to the bush was not really very an appealing prospect.
I get that, because people all over the world, don't they, they move from the countryside to the metropolis, and for a lot of Caribbean people, even people from the Commonwealth, London was the center, you know. The glamour of London was the pull. It wasn't the glamour of Suffolk, I suppose, or even of North Yorkshire or the Dales. One of the things you do early on is to remind people about some of the myths that some people think are like foundation stories of Britain, including some confounding myths like the 13 Syrian sisters. Can you explain who they were?
Absolutely. So, you know, Albion is the ancient name for Britain. Nobody knows exactly where the name came from. It's kind of rich with mystery because of that. And so it's sort of a kind of, it represents a sort of alternative history or past for the nation. I sort of see it as an alternative spirit of the nation. And, you know, I think it was first mentioned by ancient Greek geographers, I think back in the 4th century or something like that. And in the 12th century, you have Geoffrey of Monmouth, a kind of historian in inverted commas, because I'm not sure how much of it was based on fact. But, you know, he kind of wrote about, he wrote these legends of Albion, and he wrote about how, you know, Albion was a land of demonic giants until the arrival of the Trojan hero Brutus, who wiped them out and renamed the island Britain. But after Geoffrey of Monmouth, you had other scholars and poets trying to sort of fill in the gaps, or how did the giants get there? And then you get this fascinating story of Albina and her 30 naughty sisters. And Albina was supposedly the daughter of a Syrian king, sometimes Greek. And she and her 30 sisters were known for their extraordinary beauty, but also their disobedience, and they plotted to murder their husbands in the night, and they were found out and they were exiled from Syria. So Albina and her sisters, they sail the seas, they go in search of a new home, and they discover, they kind of come across a beautiful uninhabited island, which Albina names Albion. And so you get this kind of very interesting part of the story where the sisters, who have kind of been used to living in the lap of luxury, they learn to hunt the island's wild animals, they sort of learn to forage and become self-sufficient, living in a kind of feminist utopia for a little while, until they begin to pine for male company and procreate with demons, basically, and give birth to the race of giants. And obviously there's you know, sort of bit of misogyny in that story, but I think it's very interesting that in these kind of foundational myths about Britain, we get Syrian refugees arriving in small boats to start a new life. You know, even Brutus, supposed founder of Britain, was from Troy, you know. So I think I came across this myth when I was researching the book, and I'd never heard of it before. And I sort of think, how different might things be if Albina was one of our kind of British symbols instead of Britannia, you know, who represents kind of, well, it's obviously kind of taken on from the Romans, but sort of is a representative of this imperial might. What if we made Albina a Syrian princess, a Syrian refugee? You know, what if she was at the heart of our kind of national kind of insignia? And so I think it's a story that needs to be known.
I'd sign up for that one, I'm sure. So you're also interested in changing the narratives, because actually you are the story that you tell yourself. And one of the things you posit in the book is that of all the nations of Great Britain, the English are less sure about their identity. And I think you are suggesting that because they were invested in the notion of Great Britain, they let go of some of their identity. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I think that's the chapter I'm sort of thinking about Welshness. And, you know, Wales was where, as a child or as a young person, I encountered a sort of sense of national identity that was infectious and joyous and celebratory and welcoming, you know, rather than threatening. And, you know, sort of growing up, even to this day, I was in Wales over the weekend, and you know, you see the Welsh flag everywhere, and it elicits It evokes a very different response in me to the St. George's Cross, which is ostensibly my flag. And so I was sort of thinking about why that was. And yes, absolutely. You know, the Welsh national identity as we know it today, you know, I sort of had a lot of the symbols and kind of stories of Welshness sort of are rooted in much older kind of tales and myths and symbols. But they're really kind of consciously conjured after the Union of 1707. You know, there was an attempt, there was a kind of collaborative effort with kind of poets and scholars and rich benefactors sort of trying to cultivate a distinct sense of Welshness that could sort of hold its own within the Union. And of course, you know, this was a sense of national identity that was forged in opposition to, or always in the face of, English domination. Mm-hmm. Englishness obviously has a very, very different flavour. Because, you know, I quoted a sociologist who kind of talked about England being, you know, the driving force of the British project. And so as a result, English symbols and British symbols, and in fact, kind of Englishness and Britishness are quite often sort of muddied and sort of mingled, and it can be quite hard to separate them. I suppose because for a long time, cultivating that kind of distinct sense of Englishness as separate from the British project was never really a priority. And you see this in the way that, you know, now that kind of imperial project that both the Welsh and the Scots, you know, benefited a lot from being part of, now that that's sort of broken down, you know, the Welsh and the Scots have sort of returned to their kind of older, distinct sort of identifiers. And that's sort of reflected in the way that people describe themselves. I think in the recent census, you know, it was absolutely Welsh people putting Welsh first and British second, and the same for the Scots. Whereas for the English, this British and English are still kind of interchangeable. And so, you know, in the book, I'm sort of saying, well, perhaps we need to do something similar to what the Welsh did in the 18th and 19th centuries. You know, there needs to be a kind of collective, conscious conjuring of new symbols, new stories, new kind of anthems and mottos to carry us through this next sort of chapter. And I think that we should, like the Welsh did and like many other nations did during that era of kind of nationalisms, look to some of our older stories and customs for inspiration.
One of the things you do explain, I think, very clearly is that all these traditions are invented. And you mentioned the 19th century aristocrat Augusta Hall. What impact did she have on the idea of Welshness?
Well, yes, she was this rich benefactor, the Lady of Llanova, and she was really one of the main people who was celebrating Welsh kind of folk tradition during the era. And she used to hold Welsh folk dance events on her estate. And, you know, the kind of typical Welsh national dress was sort of semi-invented by her. She kind of brought together various different kind of traditional modes of dress in Wales. They weren't kind of one distinct outfit at the time. And she kind of championed this as a kind of expression of Welsh identity. So, you know, it's very interesting to think about the kind of constructedness of national identities, and yet I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. I think it kind of gives us permission to sort of reimagine them and dream them anew.
Yeah, I agree. One of the things my parents are Jamaican. One of the things my mum used to say to me is that you will be known by the company that you keep. How do you feel about associating yourself with Morris dancers? Were they welcoming?
They were very welcoming, yeah. Well, you know, as I said, this was something that I kept secret for a long time, my kind of enthusiasm about folk culture, because I didn't grow up in a folky atmosphere, and there weren't many people like me that seemed to be interested in folk culture. And I think there is a kind of sense of shame or definitely embarrassment, I think, that a lot of people feel, particularly in England, about our folk customs. You know, it was quite funny. There was a kind of, you know, quote that I found that Charlie Corcoran, who was kind of leader of a kind of particular Morris organization about 10 years ago, feared that Morris dancing would go extinct because young people were too embarrassed to be involved in it. And, you know, it's quite interesting thinking about what that shame or embarrassment is about. Is it because when we see Morris dancers kind of bashing sticks on cobbled streets that they kind of counter or challenge some of the more highfalutin own kind of, you know, ideas or visions about what Englishness really is. But for me, that's part of the joy. But no, the Morris dancers are very welcoming. I've got a big up an incredible Morris dancing side based in Stroud called Boss Morris, who actually gave me a Morris lesson, although it's very hard on the knees, I will say. but they, you know, they're kind of really trying to reimagine Morris, the Morris tradition, as an inclusive tradition. You know, they dance in these incredible outlandish outfits. They dance to kind of like, you know, UK garage remixes of Morris tunes. And they've just started this incredible series of events where they're teaching Morris dancing to young people of all different walks of life, you know, trying to sort of democratize and trying to sort of show people that there are aspects of English, the English folk tradition, that are welcoming and inviting and that we can all be part of. So they are part of this kind of much wider wave of people becoming more interested in folk traditions and sort of trying to promote them as an inclusive aspect of our culture.
So does it help that they no longer don blackface?
Well, Boss Morris never did, just to, for the record. But yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was, you know, when you sort of, you start, your first question was, you know, what did I hope to find when I set out on this quest? And I think, you know, you heard Pentangle earlier, and you heard that kind of the magic of that music. And so I think that when I set off my quest to sort of learn more about our folk culture in this country, I probably hoped that I would find this kind of unsullied, uncompromised idyll, right? Albion, some kind of joyous paradise where I would, you know, where I would feel like I could belong. And then I realized that, you know, that there had been blackface in Morris dancing, which rather punctured that that fantasy. You know, this is a very troublesome aspect of the folk tradition, and it's not, you know, the only troublesome aspect. You know, I think for a long time, there are certain sides within the Morris tradition that have historically painted their faces black when they perform. They would say probably that this relates to a kind of older tradition of disguise, you know, working class people wanting to conceal their identities when they were out on the streets at the various fêtes and fairs that they'd be performing at. The more recent research suggests that actually there's limited evidence for the use of blackface before the minstrel craze, basically. And, you know, so as a result, the Morris Federation back in 2020, after the murder of George Floyd, said, we don't want anyone to feel kind of hurt or offended by the use of blackface, and we recognize that traditions have always evolved and changed with the time, so they banned its use. But you know, this is just one example of where you know, these kind of the more troublesome aspects of our history, the kind of shadow aspects of the British psyche, kind of find their way into folk.
One of the things I love about your book is that you show that culture is porous. It's not boxed in, it's going to leak in and leak out. And I think the next song, please, Mark, or I hope that's your name, could we have the next song which sort of speaks to this notion? Can you tell us what that song is and how that fits into your thesis?
Absolutely. So that is a piece of music recorded by the American ethnomusicologist Alan Lomax in the early 60s on a visit to Karaku, which is where my family come from. And it is an example, it's a quadrille. It was performed by a violinist called Canute Callist. And I absolutely love that piece of music, because in that it's just the collision of worlds. You know, you can hear the kind of Irish, Scottish kind of folk influences there on the violins. And then there's this kind of wonderful kind of tumbling kind of West African rhythms imported to the island, you know, brought to the island by enslaved peoples. And that piece of music, you know, Karakou, there was a big Scottish influence and presence in Karakou during the colonial era. There's one kind of part of the island where everyone has Scottish last names, and there's a kind of wooden boat building tradition, and they play this music. And I suppose, you know, this is just one example that I found through my research of British folk traditions that made their way to the former colonies and were reimagined and reinterpreted. And, you know, I also discovered the use of the maypole dancing tradition in Jamaica. I don't know if you know about that one. You know, there was one folk researcher found a kind of versions of mummers' plays on an island called St. Kitts, as well as Morris dancing. And I had absolutely no idea about the way that these traditions had traveled. Mm. And yet, you know, they were fascinating for me to sort of discover these kind of strange fusions of culture, and to think about, as you say, the way in which these traditions kind of flow back and forth and have done for many, many centuries. They kind of counter the idea that kind of, you know, blackness and Britishness, Caribbean and Britishness is something that sort of started when the Windrushes came over, that actually there's this long entangled history, and that their beauty came out of that darkness and those shadow aspects of our
past. I agree. I mean, I did a documentary about mento, which is an early form of reggae, before ska, and before mento, there was folk music. And I remember I was taught when I was in Jamaica to rent a tile. Do you know what rent a tile means?
No.
So you go to a dance hall, you stand on a square tile, a foot square, you grab someone that you're interested in, and you just rent the tile all night long. The person. Yes, rent a tile. One of the things that you do very well also is to explore the fact that the land is not always available to people. And there are various folk songs of people who've transgressed, become poachers, and have been sent and to colonies to rid them of the disgrace. And some of those stories have worked their ways into folk songs. Can you talk about one or two of those?
Absolutely, yeah. I suppose it's important, you know, what is folk? It's quite hard to define. But one of the things, I suppose, that sort of is common when we're thinking about folk culture, you know, these old songs, old customs, old tales, you know, they're traditionally the expressions of marginalized people, be that the working classes, women, subjects of the empire, people who are traditionally sort of excluded from the institutions and the academies, who had to find other ways to tell their stories. So when we look to, for example, the folk song repertoire in England, what we get are these kind of alternative histories that often kind of trouble the dominant narratives, and that's why I think that they're a really important place to look when we're seeking alternative visions of England or indeed Britain. So one of the songs that I focus on in the book is a song called The Rufford Park Poachers, which was covered by a couple of musicians during the kind of 60s revival. But it was recorded by a very dodgy fellow called Percy Grainger, who was a bit of a fascist. That's a whole other story. But he recorded this this folk song, a folk singer called Joseph Taylor, singing it in 1908. And I'm not going to sing the lyrics, but I think I can remember them. There's this beautiful refrain in it, which is, "A buck or doe, believe it so, a pheasant or a hare, were set on earth for everyone quite equal for to share. So poacher bold, as I unfold, keep up your gallant heart and think about those poachers bold that night in Rufford Park." And what he's singing about is a real life clash that happened between poachers and gamekeepers on the land of the Earl of Scarborough in 1851. And although the speaker in the song suggests that these animals were put on earth quite equal for to share, the reality was that for, you know, working class people at that time who were hungry and often, you know, had for many years poached wild animals to supplement their meager diets, you could be transported for up to 15 years to a penal colony for doing so. And sort of sitting with that song and sort of learning about the history behind that song revealed to me this long history of protest in England, you know, protests against enclosure, the Luddites, who were kind of setting fire to mills in a very close to where that clash between poachers and gamekeepers happened in Nottinghamshire, stretching back to, you know, Kett's Rebellion, the diggers, you know, who kind of set up communes during the English Civil War and declared the earth a common treasury for all. And this was a whole kind of radical history of England that I didn't really know about. I hadn't learned about it at school. And yet, you know, when we're trying to think about alternative narratives, alternative heroes to counter the toxic and exclusionary visions of Englishness that are getting a lot of airtime at the moment, you know, conjured by the far right, this feels like a really important place to look. And another very fascinating thread that kind of was revealed as I began to unpick that song was this kind of interrelated sort of destinies of the kind of white working classes in England and the subjects of the empire, enslaved peoples, you know, the money that flowed from the nefarious kind of activities of the British Empire into the land, you know, as you know, people like Corin Fowler and others have kind of made known in recent years, you know, the huge payout that former slave owners got when slavery was abolished, you know, so much of that went into buying land, which enclosed more of the landscape and pushed, you know, severed communities from the land. So this, to me, is like this kind of, you know, it's evidence of a shared struggle, and it's a story that should get a lot more airtime.
I think you're right. I think when I grew up in Luton, I grew up with Irish kids, so it was anybody but the English, and we used to have this game where we play who'd been done worse by the English, and we'd say, yeah, we've been under the heel of the English for 400 years, man. There's terrible people, and the Irish kids would say, no, we've been under the heel of the English for 800 years. And a little while ago, I did a talk with a friend of mine who's half Irish, half Yoruba, and we called the talk "Tired of Being Black, Try Being Irish." One of the things I also love is that you talk about these alternative histories or alternative narratives, and you mentioned some folk musicians like the Shuffle Dance Collective who are bringing a new spin to some of these old songs, and sometimes including and writing their own songs. And one of the people we're going to hear now, please, Mark, is Angeline Morrison. We'll talk about her and what she's doing for folk music.
Country, how sweetly your siren song sounds o'er the sea. If it weren't for your arms, an orphan I'd be. Oh, mother, my mother, cruel mother country.
We both love Angeline Morrison, don't we? Why do we love her? What's so great about her?
I love Angeline Morrison because this song that you just heard is from an album that she made called The Sorrow Songs, and that came out a few years back. And they're a series of songs kind of steeped in the old folk cadences and melodies, but they're new songs that she wrote that are inspired by the lives and experiences of real Black Britons over the centuries. And I saw her perform a few years back, and you know, she was singing. They're quite dark. They're beautiful. They're quite melancholic, and they're dark. They are the sorrow songs. That's unsurprising. And she, you know, she goes around to the folk festivals, you know, multiple times a year, and she sings these dark songs, you know, that are basically, you know, forcing often white audiences to confront the colonial past, and doing it with grace and doing it in song in a way that I think in a way that sort of reaches people in a way that sometimes the kind of intellectual on the intellectual kind of level it's harder to accept. And she actually she sang at my book launch, and I got, you know, as I mentioned, I'm not like deep down folky. My friends are not folky at all. And, you know, she got the whole room singing these old folk songs. And there was just something about the magic of singing together. You know, I saw people come out of their shells. I saw the kind of the power that singing these old songs that deal with universal themes of love and loss, the power that they have to connect us, you know, regardless of our backgrounds, regardless of our perspectives and where we're coming from. And so as a channel for that kind of spirit of folk and the unifying power of folk, I think Angeline is absolutely incredible.
Yeah, she makes me think that folk music's pretty cool. In a way, you've kind of found the centre of Britain through this book, I feel, a new centre that we ought to go to. So let's put our hands together and thank Sakya.
Thank you.
Zakia Zuhl was in conversation with Colin Grant. To hear more writers, go to writersmosaic.org.uk.